Welcome to Military History Inside Out, a podcast devoted to the study of how war has been waged across the centuries. Hello, in today's Military History Podcast, I interview Jeremy Stoes. I probably ruined that pronunciation. He's Austrian and American, and he wrote a book about the decline of European naval forces between the end of the Cold War and now. So we discuss, obviously, that issue, how these various countries, what their missions were, what they became, how they've dealt with all of that. We talk about the process of the research he did for this book, the resources he used, that sort of thing. So definitely very interesting talk about the recent military history, specifically on naval history. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Jeremy Stoes, author of The Decline of European Naval Forces. Thank you for speaking with me.
Chris, thank you very much for having me.
So first tell me about your background in writing and history.
Well, in general, I studied history, but of course my interest for history goes back to when I was a child. Both my parents are very keen on various topics of history. They have a lot of literature at home about all kinds of historical topics. And so from a young age onwards, I was always interested in that field. And after my mandatory military service, and I worked for the police force for a couple of years in Austria, and then decided that it was not for me. So I studied English and history at the University of Graz. Graz is the second largest city in Austria. And yeah, that's where it all started. And I was fortunate enough to have professors where I could also deal with topics of contemporary history. And as you, of course, know, the issue, of course, with contemporary history is you often have a problem with sources, because a lot of things are not dealt with yet, or in the field that I work in are still classified. Mm-hmm. So I worked with and for a small center, the Austrian Center for Intelligence, Propaganda and Security Studies, which is a small think tank, and interestingly enough, the only think tank in the German-speaking world that deals with intelligence matters, so how intelligence services work, how they've worked historically, what they do today. And through this little think tank, I was able, and the professor there and my colleagues, I was able to write and publish on various security matters that were of contemporary history. And of course, every historian will always have problems with sources there, as I've already pointed out.
So just as an aside, when you're talking about contemporary history, where's the line drawn, you know, up to what point does it stop being history?
Well, I think that's a very philosophical question, and I would not, I don't think I can answer that. But what I deal with is mostly military history, security issues since the 1980s. I've studied, of course, military history that goes back further, and you have to do that to understand where you come from and what the reasons are for the developments, the broader developments. But in general, the field I'm looking at, and also in my book that I look at, is from the 80s, and then in particular from the end of the Cold War onwards. And here you do have a big problem with most of the sources, the primary sources of how military forces would be used in the case of war or the contingency planning, is still classified among many countries. So there you then have to look at other sources to get to the bottom of the questions you want to have.
So how did you come about writing a book on European naval forces?
Well, it's interesting, and one of the talking points that I always have, or the opening that I always have, is that now there's an Austrian talking about contemporary naval issues, which is actually quite funny, as Austria doesn't have a direct access to the sea. Of course, it has access through its rivers, the Danube, for example, and hence it is also dependent on the free shipping, the free lines of communication at seas, the global transport of goods is not impeded. And Austria is also a high technology country that depends on high technology, on industry, high technology industry, and hence is dependent on on-time delivery of all its goods or many of its goods. Italy, being its southern neighbor, Germany, its northern neighbor, both of them obviously have stakes at sea. So that is more or less interesting to come from a landlocked perspective, but I'm not the only one. There are other authors, too, in Austria that deal with current maritime issues, and it just shows the importance of the globalized world, the importance of the sea in the globalized world. And in my studies, and my writing, I've also looked into other security issues, of military defense issues, and then came to the conclusion that there is a lot of research on, for example, the United States Navy, the Marine Corps, also a lot of research on, obviously now at the moment, on the Chinese Navy. And there used to be, and now more again, research on the development of the Russian Navy. And there's, interestingly enough, no comprehensive overview, in my opinion, or that I've come across, regarding European naval forces and their development since the end of the Cold War. And fortunately, I chose to write about that because it seems I've hit a nerve there, and there's quite a lot of interest for that. Not least my book is obviously the most recent proof for that interest.
So tell me about the book. What's the main theme you explore?
Well, the main theme, as the title obviously already points out, is decline. What I try to do in my book is, and in my studies in general, and that is also the focus that I currently have, is to look at what are naval forces used for, and what have they been used for in the last 25 years, or since then, the Cold War, if you will, so almost 30 years. How does that differ from, let's say, the Cold War, and how have they developed both in strategic terms, so what do the individual nations, the states, want from their navies? What do they have to do? What are they called upon to do? Then the technology behind that is, of course, a topic that is discussed greatly in various different media outlets and publications. There's a lot about technology anyway. And then the third is operations. So how are they put to use? And there is this, of course, this ends, ways, means, triad, if you will, and that's what I tried to look at. But of course, there's always a disclaimer. If you do scholarly work, there has been a decline, and I'm trying to measure how drastic that decline has been and what effects it has. And that is the gist of it, if you will.
So let's go to the end of the Cold War. I guess maybe taking a few of the nations you discuss as examples. What were their naval missions right before the end of the Cold War, and then how did they change after, or did they properly adjust to the new circumstances?
Well, the interesting thing is, if you look at the end of the Cold War, there were a couple of people prudent enough to already look at the limits of the Soviet Union, or the weaknesses, if you will, of the Soviet Union. But it seems to me that many didn't see it coming, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact. And there's a very famous book by Professor Eric Grove, The Future of Sea Power, I think it is. And that was written, I think, in 89 or 90. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really foresee this development. And then a year later, there's an end to this alliance, if you will. So, and what you also cannot say is that there was one mission, or every country had a different point of view, of course. But they were within a bigger context of this security environment, they were, of course, European NATO states. They were all focused on waging conventional or nuclear war against a peer competitor, which was the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact forces. So that was their main mission. The main mission was sea denial, sea control, protection of the strategic lines of communication. So that meant, for example, mining the critical straits, such as the Danish Strait, so that the Baltic Sea Fleet of the Warsaw Pact could not move into the North Sea and into the Atlantic, fighting along the GEOC gap, that is the Greenland-Iceland-UK gap. Of course, in the 1980s, the Americans had that maritime strategy under President Reagan, which foresaw full forward pressure on the Soviet flank, so up into the North Sea as well as into the Mediterranean, and also other areas such as the Pacific, to relieve some of the stress from the central front in Europe, so draw away forces from the central front. That was the maritime strategy the Americans had in the 1980s, and the Europeans had to follow their lead within NATO. So it was, again, the Brits, for example, supporting amphibious operations, deploying forces into Norway, Turkey making sure that the Soviet Black Sea Fleet could not go through the Bosphorus and into the Mediterranean. Italian fleet deploying against Russian submarines in the Mediterranean. German, back in the days, still West German fleet also defending the Danish Straits. And those were the main roles of European naval forces. So it was sea control, sea denial, protection of the strategic lines of communication across the Atlantic, and then also forward operations, but that was mostly American forward operations, would have been with American carriers, American attack submarines, nuclear attack submarines going after the Russians. In, of course, that never occurred, so we don't know how that would have panned out anyway. But that was the military doctrine at the time, and we shouldn't forget that France, for example, was not part of NATO at that time, and it only rejoined NATO in 2008. And so they had a little bit of their own different approach to how they would use military force.
So do you focus on countries that were part of NATO plus France, or how wide is your range when you say Europe?
Well, my range is a little bit arbitrary, I have to say. I included all, I more or less touch upon all the European states that have a, if you will, a measurable a military naval component. So I touch upon, I discuss 11 countries in total. That includes Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Germany, the Netherlands, the UK, France, Spain, Italy, and then also Greece and Turkey. I touch upon the Portuguese naval forces, also the Polish naval forces, but not in and separate case studies, but there are 11 case studies in total, and they also show a little bit, getting back to your initial question, that some countries at the beginning of the 90s changed their military strategy, their outlook drastically, whereas others adhered to what we often refer to traditional military strategy, so traditional naval strategy, hunting submarines, territorial defense and things like that. In particular, Norway would be an example for that. Sweden would be an example. Finland, an example of adhering to those traditional naval roles, whereas Denmark quickly shifted, or also Germany, then quickly shifted towards out-of-area operations, being able to deploy over greater distances. So you have those shifts in there. Also, the Brits changing from their main focus from anti-submarine warfare as part of NATO during the Cold War, again, to what they maybe consider traditional, being an offshore balancer, somebody, a nation that deploys its naval forces over great distances, which it could during the Cold War, but which was not its main focus.
So after the Cold War ended, did maritime traffic increase in new areas that these European countries had to worry about or be concerned about?
Well, definitely. Maritime traffic increases year by year. Of course, you always have ups and downs depending on the situation, the current state of economies and so on. But, of course, it has increased significantly. Container transport has increased significantly, and especially where most of the production of goods has now moved to Asia, and not only Japan, which was the case maybe in the 80s, but also now China and many other places in the Asia Pacific. These lines of communication through the Indian Ocean, from China through the Malacca Strait, Indian Ocean, the Red Sea into the Mediterranean through the Suez Canal, then by Gibraltar and then up north to maybe the big ports in Rotterdam or in London, they are very important. But more so, the security situation changed as that you no longer had, at least some perceived, this major threat by Russia, whereas we had smaller conflicts popping up in the Balkans, for example, Bosnia, Kosovo, the wars in, of course, Operation Desert Storm, and the conflicts in the Persian Gulf, where for the first time, countries, European countries, deployed their naval forces into those areas, which they had not done before. And I'm talking about, for example, Germany deploying to the Mediterranean, an area that they had not operated before. And they did that in the early 90s already, deploying to Somalia for operations to get their own, to get their people out of there, and other operations where they were not outside the traditional NATO area of operation, down Red Sea, Horn of Africa. And that was the case in the 1990s. But others, as I already mentioned, were still very much focused on, for various reasons, territorial defense. Norway, for example, Sweden and Finland. Obviously, Finland has a long border with Russia, so territorial defense still, to this day, is one of the principal roles and focuses that they have. With Greece and Turkey, on the other hand, it was the animosity between those two NATO allies that more or less led them to develop similar naval forces. If you just look at the posture of the or the fleet structure, if you will, if you compare that, you see significant investments among Greece and Turkey throughout the 1990s, whereas with many other countries, the investments declined. But because of that animosity and the antagonism between those two countries, military forces and naval forces were still invested in.
So with the decline, would you say, was there also a decline in the number of how often these countries' naval leadership met and discussed the new situation, or did it become more? Did they meet more often because now there was less that they were less sure of what was going on?
Well, the decline that I talk about is very much platform centric. Mm-hmm. So the decline that I look at is both budgetary, how much money is being spent on military forces and on naval forces. And in my book, I provide some graphics, some illustrations that that point that out. So how much money is being spent in times of peace or relative peace, and how many platforms are being built and are being used. And although it can be criticized, this bean counting exercise is still the most basic element of measuring military power. If you look at somebody, a country, a state, you always first count how many troops it has, how many tanks it has. In the second instance, you will then look what are their capabilities, which sensors do they have on there, which weapon systems do they have on there. And only then do you look at, unfortunately, because it's difficult to measure, how professional are their crews, how good are they at things like damage control, or operating joint and combined. That means with other services such as air and land, or with allies. That is a huge advantage that the NATO countries have, that they have certain procedures that they all adhere to, that they all know, that they all practice on a daily basis, and therefore know they communicate with each other. For example, the German Navy communicates within the German Navy, they communicate in English from ship to ship. So it's no problem if then a German ship wants to talk to a British vessel, for example. So that is the main focus. And to your question, I actually didn't look into how often they met, but of course, or how much discussion there was. But of course, there was a lot of discussion on issues such as what is the role of naval forces in the post-Cold War era? What is the utility of a military force to intervene in genocides, for example, such as in Bosnia, and then what did not happen in Uganda, for example, in the 1990s. And so the decline is definitely that I look at is in platforms, and it is in men and materiel, it's in funding, which has led to this situation we are in now, that all of a sudden everybody's waking up and realizing, okay, we might have underinvested over the last 25 years, or maybe also invested in the wrong areas.
So, since we know there's been a decline, where would you say within the naval budgets, where have you seen the most drastic or out of sync declines within the navies?
Well, as I mentioned before, it's very difficult to pinpoint certain, because every navy is different. Every navy, that's something people have to understand. I think there's too much focus on big navies. There is a focus always and in every discussion on the U.S. Navy as the model for a great navy with all its power that it has, together with the Marine Corps and the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard, the U.S. Coast Guard, would be a capable navy for itself for another country. So you have really small states like Malta, for example, or other smaller states like Slovenia that only have a short or very short ocean line, very little access to the sea. And they, of course, have different focus or a different need for naval forces and different means for naval forces than the bigger country. So what you just see, and that affects all military branches throughout the 1990s, and then particularly during the 2000s, is a rapid decrease of defense spending from an average of a little over, well, depending on which country you look at, over 2%. Sometimes 3%, sometimes 3.5% of gross domestic product, so GDP, down to 1%, 1.2, 1.3. Of course, that has to be taken with a grain of salt, because if you're doing economically well and you're well off and you invest 1%, it can be more than another country that is financially not well off and invests 1.5. So that has to always be taken with a grain of salt. I also want to mention that there has been a decline in platforms, and that is something, if you look in more detail, that is true that, in my opinion, European naval forces have been in steep decline and don't have the capabilities that, in my opinion, many of them should have. On the other hand, the problem with bean counting exercises is, and just measuring and just comparing how many vessels, how many ships, how many airplanes one has compared to 1990, isn't really helpful, because a vessel nowadays, a ship, anything, is much more capable, has a longer range, much better sensors than it would have 25 years ago. It might be able to strike targets on land. It might be able to deploy special forces. It might be able to communicate with other platforms, and which is so important nowadays, that you really have battle space awareness to a much greater degree than that was possible. So you always, what you actually have to do, you really have to assess military capability as best possible and compare it to what other states are doing. Mm-hmm. And then you can compare it, because it is always relative. You always have to compare it to relative to somebody else. Otherwise, you just say, okay, we have half as many ships as in 1990, but those ships might be much bigger, much better, much more professional, better crews, be able to deploy over far greater distances. And the crews trained not only to fight submarines, but also to conduct humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. And that is what we see, this trend, definitely during the 1990s and 2000s, is that at the high-intensity area of the intensity spectrum, so the high-intensity warfighting capabilities were atrophied and were lost because it wasn't exercised enough, because it wasn't a focus, whereas low-intensity operations, the so-called constabulary operations, were front and center. They were important stability operations, providing peacekeeping operations and such things. And they're much better now at doing that, European naval forces, than they were 30 years ago. But they have lost capabilities in the high-intensity area. And that's what they are now trying to regain.
Hmm. Okay, so let me ask you, what are the resources you use to do your research?
The resources, so as I mentioned at the beginning, there is always the problem if I talk to historians, they will always say, oh, you're really running a risk with your research because you don't have access to the primary sources. I'm fortunate that they work here in Germany, in Kiel, for the Center for Maritime Strategy and Security at the Institute for Security Policy in Kiel. So I have a lot of colleagues that have access to various people and various sources that I can draw upon. At the same time, what I do in my study is I look at the official publications and white papers, official statements by the states throughout this period of time. And there are more or less three or four levels to that. You have a grand strategy level, which is national security. You have a publication maybe for that. Underneath that, you have military strategy publications. Underneath that, you would have either a maritime or a naval strategy, if so at all. And again, there's a difference between maritime, which is much more comprehensive, than naval, which is much more really only about how to use naval forces and doesn't look at other aspects. And underneath that, you would then have either naval or maritime doctrine. So how do you use those forces? And then various other sources. So there are those levels, and you always have, and they're public, they're open source. So you always have to know, okay, who is actually addressed in those sources? And then again, you have to be smart and read between the lines and understand, okay, what is the reason behind publishing things like that? But they give you a general idea of where a nation, where a state is heading, what its security considerations are, what its focuses are, and they can give you a trend. At the same time, another primary source would be official statements by senior political or military leaders. Again, with the caveat that it might actually be a political statement either to assure allies or to get more money or something like that. And the other sources are, of course, secondary sources. In particular, when military technology is concerned, there's a lot of literature out there on military technology. There are articles, blogs, online as well as in print. And those are my sources because I don't have access to or any security clearances. So I'm limited what my research is concerned. If I would be looking at the European naval forces in the 1920s, I could go to the archives and really find something about that. But I think still with the sources I have and looking at force composition, looking at the operations, it gives you an idea and it lets you understand and lets us understand what does Italy, for example, need from its Navy? What is its focus? How does it plan its procurement processes? And how does it deploy its naval forces? And I think that is the benefit or the what my study and my studies, the advantage that they have and that they show.
Were you able to do any interviews or were you able to bounce your ideas off other colleagues? Were there a lot of people available to help with that? Or
the fortunate thing is that the maritime community, interestingly enough, is very relatively small. So I've been working on this for a couple of years now, you know a lot of people, and it's something that everybody I've met has been very helpful. There has been, I think, the issue of sea blindness is something that brings everybody together. So there's a sense that governments, politicians, and the people, citizens of states, don't understand the relevance and importance of the sea for the prosperity and the security of states. That's the case in the UK, that's the case here, that's most likely the case in Italy and everywhere else in the United States, most likely just the same. So there is this notion that we have to work together. And many colleagues, both military and civilian, have been very forthcoming, but also with the U.S. Navy, colleagues at the U.S. Navy and think tanks such as the Center for Naval Analyses in Virginia have been very forthcoming with helping me out with my research, pointing me in the right directions. Former chiefs of naval staff have helped me out in answering questions that I had. Because it's difficult to analyze the development of different countries because they published, in particular in the 1990s and 2000s, still very much, they published a lot of things in their own native languages. So you have Italian documents, you have Spanish documents, and maybe also even the white papers and the official statements aren't translated. Nowadays, that's easier because more documents are available in English. Mm-hmm. But it's difficult, especially in the 1990s, to find those documents and then see what is important and to distinguish between what is important and what is not.
What part of the research was most enjoyable?
Well, it is an ongoing process. I'm currently working in that field and still working, so the book is not the end of the, it's just one of the milestones, and I'm happy that it will be published now in March. I'm very thankful also to Naval Institute Press for being so forthcoming and helpful with the publication of this book, which is not self-explanatory, especially for a relatively young scholar as I am, to have a book published with the Naval Institute Press. So the enjoyable thing is just to realize that the community is relatively small, that people are working together to promote maritime strategy, understand the importance of the ocean in all its forms, not only as a medium to use military power or to transport goods, but in many other ways too. And I think that is the most enjoyable, that fortunately when we now live in a time where there is the realization how important the ocean actually is, and that you can't only look at one aspect and entirely ignore all the other aspects. And also that I think a lot of the bias and towards maybe also either scholars from point of the military towards scholars as well as within the academic world is now, there's less bias towards each other, that actually there's a sense we have to work together. What can I learn from you? What do I need for my research? And I think that is the most enjoyable part of my work that I do.
One thing you said that brought a question to mind is, when I think of Europe, I think of all, you know, the coastlines. And while I understand that, you know, the Navy might not be big in the minds of the citizens, I would imagine that commerce, you know, fishing, that sort of thing might be a lot larger in the minds of Europeans. Is that incorrect?
Well, I couldn't say because I don't know. I haven't read all too many studies how big it is in the minds of the Americans or in the Chinese. But of course, the Europeans, the big fishing fleets are, for example, China. China has a huge fishing fleet. There are a lot more people who are invested in the maritime domain, if you will, than here in Germany or even in the UK. If you think about it, a couple of hundred years ago, half of London, I'm exaggerating here, but half of London was somehow involved with the maritime industry because they were working to build the ships and so on and so forth. And that is not the case anymore. You have a drastic reduction of and the decline of shipbuilding facilities, of naval yards. There are very few in the States as well as in Europe. There are very few naval yards left that can produce that high technology. It is also not the same as in the 1940s, where you could just build one ship after the other. That takes years to build ships. It's highly complex with now with command and control and information, surveillance, reconnaissance, all those elements in there. You need net-centric warfare. You need to communicate with satellites, but also be able to, if the satellite is blinded or spoofed, you also have to be able to communicate on high frequency, or you just need to be able to have short lines of communication that you can use if you're in a contested environment and such things. Mm. So that is definitely that. I think there is a change in a slow process is ongoing, that there's a realization and an understanding of the importance both of naval forces and not only the military element. That's also a point I make, and I think that is really important, especially in this point of time, that naval forces are not only used for the military role. They have, everybody who deals with this issue knows that there's also the diplomatic role as well as a constabulary role. And especially during the 2000s, you see a lot of countries really work towards and really emphasize this constabulary role of naval forces being able to go over, to deploy over great distances into the Indian Ocean as the German Navy, for example, or deploy as the Netherlands to its overseas territories with platforms that are not specifically designed for high-intensity warfighting, because that is a daily role. Anti-piracy hunting, anti-piracy missions are front and center. Fishery protection is becoming more and more important. All those constabulary roles that are not only warfighting were really important in 2000. Something you should not forget is that in 2007 with the Eurodebt crisis, and that really was detrimental to the defense budgets in throughout Europe. Even those countries who maybe up until then were able to more or less slow that decline that they had, that was really difficult for all the states in Europe. And there were cuts, drastic cuts, for example, for the Royal Navy, not to continue their maritime patrol aircraft. And then what you have is then 10 years without a maritime patrol aircraft. And all of a sudden the Russians are knocking at your back door again. And then you don't have a maritime patrol aircraft to cover that area and search for submarines. So you see, with naval forces, it takes very long to build ships. They have very long service life. It's usually 30 years, 40 years. So from the first drawing on a drawing board until the ship is taken for decommissioned can be 50 years or more. So you have to think ahead. And of course, politicians are not always very, how should I put this? Yeah, they don't always think in 10 or 20 and 30 years, but more often 4 year or 5 year cycles.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask, as you spoke, it made me wonder about certain countries that I would imagine have a very strong maritime tradition, namely, say, Norway, Denmark, UK, Portugal, Italy, Greece. You know, it's interesting to me. I would imagine that they would think strongly about maritime protection, but maybe it's just territories and, like you say, not necessarily the Navy, you know, territorial defense.
Yes, I mean, that would be a study in its own to look at how a naval tradition or maritime tradition influences decision-making. And maybe, going out on a limb here, but maybe my argument would be it doesn't count that much what the investments are concerned. I would always say European naval force is highly professional. NATO, and also now with European navies who aren't in NATO, for example, Sweden and Finland, they're also highly professional. They exercise, they cooperate with NATO nations. We have standing NATO maritime groups who are on deployment all the time, four of them to count mine countermeasure and to normal standing maritime forces groups. So they can really work well together, and everybody else is actually quite jealous, I would argue, if people from India look over at NATO and say, okay, that's actually what we would like to have, or even the Japanese and the South Koreans, who don't see eye to eye, unfortunately, for historical reasons and others, don't have that level of cooperation. So that is definitely, I wouldn't argue that the maritime tradition necessarily provides the basis for capable and forward-looking naval forces. I think, for example, Greece and Turkey, which both have a rich naval tradition, maritime tradition, that goes back millennia, unfortunately, for political reasons of different kinds, I would argue don't use their military instruments as they to the best degree. And, for example, in Greece, you have a lot of bribery cases. It's not quite clear mismanagement. It's not quite clear how the procurement processes work. There are big legal issues when Greece acquired German submarines, and very shady business going on in some aspects, whereas we all know the current state of in Turkey is also very difficult and definitely something that is not good for Europe, not good for NATO. And then you have those two opposing states, if you will, within NATO, one being Greece and one being Turkey. And I think that keeps them from using their military forces and their naval forces to a better degree, from using them the best they can. That is definitely the merit. But I agree with you that maritime culture, as in Royal Navy, also in French Navy, Italians, definitely plays a role.
What did you find most surprising in your research?
Well, to be honest, the degree of decline and the lack of foresight among decision makers and politicians, that was, for me, is incomprehensible how you can be so short-sighted. As I mentioned before, naval forces are something you can't develop overnight, that you can't build overnight. And if you make a decision now, it will have an effect in 20 years, it will have an effect in 30 years. And I take the example of Netherlands. Netherlands are very smart in many ways in that they have very close cooperation with the Brits, with a joint amphibious force or a combined amphibious force that they have since the 70s. They have close cooperations with Germany as well as with Belgium, maybe the closest naval cooperation and military cooperation of all European states within Europe and within NATO. But during the 2000s, they decided to more or less slash half of their fleet, more than half of the fleet, and that ended up in them now having 6 frigates and 4 offshore patrol vessels among some larger amphibious vessels. And if you look at that, they will not be able to recuperate, if you will. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the decisions back in the 2000s, there was a plan and why, and everything was explained why they were doing that. But it was mostly because they had too little money, because the government was not willing on spend more money on defense and hence on the Navy. And therefore, they had to make tough decisions. And the decision back in the day was to, for example, build 4 offshore patrol vessels. Now, those offshore patrol vessels are great because Netherlands has overseas territories, and they're good to patrol those, but they're not good for high-intensity warfighting, mm-hmm. if that ever comes to be. They also don't have a deterrent effect. At the same time, the Netherlands sold their maritime patrol aircraft, and then you don't have a maritime patrol aircraft because you don't have any anymore. So those are the decisions. And in Germany, there's currently this discussion because we also decided to become more expeditionary. But, of course, that doesn't mean that we will build a big landing platform docks, an amphibious assault ship, as it is sometimes called. Mm-hmm. That's impossible for Germany still at the moment for political reasons, for the history. But we will build what is called a stabilization frigate. There's a lot of criticism going around currently because that was a design to deploy, for example, to the Indian Ocean, further distances, have crews that are rotated, so very good living conditions on that ship, and the crews would be rotated on station. So the ship would stay there for 2 years, should be able to stay there for 2 years, and you just change the crews. So you're on station much, so it costs less money, all of that stuff. But at the same time, the weapon systems are, many argue that they're not sufficient. They don't have sufficient defense capabilities for high-intensity warfighting. And that is the decision that you make in the 2000s. Now the ships will be joining the German Navy soon in the 2020s, and you will most likely have your ship in 2045. So that's maybe what was most striking to me, is the short-sightedness and not thinking long-term and spending too little on defense.
So I know you mentioned you don't have access to classified information, obviously, but what would you say was otherwise the most difficult part to research that you would really like to get an answer for but haven't been able to yet?
Exactly. What I'm doing currently is I'm continuing work on this topic. So what I'm currently doing is still at the Center for Maritime Strategy and Security. I'm still focusing on the development of European naval forces, because, of course, when you finish any book, anybody who has ever written a book knows that. That is, if you open it up a month later, you're like, there's so much unanswered, there's so many things that I would have to qualify. And this is just the first test balloon, if you will. It's just the first book, and I hope there will be more. So what I really need to look at is really get to the bottom of what the discussion was in the individual countries on how to use what the role of naval forces was. Because as I mentioned before, the issue is knowing what was the discussion in Italy, in Rome, what was the discussion in the 1990s, how to use their naval forces, and how would they build their navy for the future security challenges and challenges in general. And what was that? What was the case, or how did that look like in Spain, and how did that look like in Poland? And for that, I have to, of course, go around, try to look at the primary sources, if available, talk to the people, talk to the decision makers. Fortunately, there are former chiefs of the Navy who are very, who are kind enough to give me were kind enough that I can have interviews with them, so I can interview those former chiefs of the Navy. And some sources are now, for example, in Germany, are now being declassified. Up until, I think now we're up until 1996 or 1998. So you can have a look at that, whereby, of course, I would, because of the breadth of the topic, because I'm looking at so many different aspects, I'm looking at technology, I'm looking at operations, I'm looking at strategy. I am dependent on other people doing the research in the archives on the documents, and then I can go to those people who I know and say, okay, what did you find out? What was the discussion? Can you point me to the right document? Because for obvious reasons, I cannot go into every archive across Europe and then still want to understand the naval technology aspect and talk to the shipbuilders and talk to the captain who commanded the ship at an anti-piracy operation off the Horn of Africa. That's just too much.
What do you hope the book will do? Do you want it to change the way policymakers think, or?
Well, I think that's aiming quite high. I think that is something that that is changing, at least in Europe and at least in the German community. There is much more discussion on maritime issues. There's a much more comprehensive approach towards the maritime sphere, including everybody from ocean governance, sustainability, blue growth, the shipbuilders, the industry, the biologists, the security and defense experts. So they're more or less written, and the military, and they're trying to bring more and more people together to really deal with those challenges we will be facing together in the future. And so what the book will do is actually raise the awareness for European naval forces, because as I said before, there's a huge focus on the U.S. Navy and the Chinese Navy at the moment. Maybe in the States also more focused on the Russian Navy. And relatively, and then maybe also on the Royal Navy and so on, but there's no comprehensive study of what European navies as a whole are doing. And of course, the term European is quite difficult to define, because what is Europe? Mm-hmm. Europe is Turkey Europe? I would say yes, and they're a NATO ally. Mm-hmm. But is Russia Europe? Well, geographically they are, so I would have to still think of them. But what I'm trying to say is, of course, I'm thinking of Western Europe, and that includes, of course, all NATO and EU countries, as well as Austria and Switzerland, although we're neutral. But interesting point I just want to make here. Austria deployed for the first time, deployed special forces on a German vessel in the Mediterranean. So it goes to show that even a neutral country in a EU mission will deploy its special forces on a German ship in the Mediterranean. And that just, I think that's something that just shows how important also maritime security is for a landlocked country. And the investments that are being made by a landlocked neutral country to add and to help in achieving maritime and helping to achieve maritime security or enforce maritime security. So I hope that it will raise some eyebrows, especially stateside in the United States, as there are not that many books that have this comparative element of European naval forces, and also draw their attention to our center here in Kiel, which deals with maritime security. Kiel is a port city, a German naval base is here in Kiel. Big German naval yards are here in Kiel. The Kiel Canal that goes to the North Sea from the Baltic Sea to the North Sea is here. So I think we're at the center of, if you will, of a European maritime discussion. And that's what we're trying to promote with our conferences, with our publications. And I think that is what the aim is with my book, to just raise awareness among the maritime community. And if we reach any policymaker, that's a bonus, I would say.
Can you briefly speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book published and how you overcame those?
I have to say, it's from my experience, or I have to say not my experience, but the experience of some of the colleagues, it's increasingly difficult to have books published. Maybe you have made the same experience, especially for young scholars. Often you have to pay a substantial, at least in Europe and in the German-speaking world, it is the case, you have to pay a significant amount of money to have a book published if you don't do it on print on demand. So I was very fortunate that the Naval Institute Press was willing and able to publish, help me publish my book. It was actually more or less smooth sailing all along. I sent my manuscript. No pun intended here. Sent them my manuscript, got the peer review, which was very, very helpful. I have to say that still want to meet that person, although it's someday, because it was very helpful peer review also from my current research to really pinpoint, okay, where are the limitations of my book and of my research. And then, from there it was all very professional, very good work. And, yeah.
So where can people find your work or the work of the Institute?
Well, the Institute for Security Policy at Keele University, obviously okay, you can find it online. We're on Twitter. Now you will have to hold because now I can tell you the email at the internet address.
Okay.
Have it up in my head.
Sure thing.
So our work from our center that is part of the Institute for Security Policy is can be found under www.keelecpowerseries.com. So it's we more or less we have a CPower series under which all of our work is published. We are on Twitter under Keele CPower series. We have various books that have been published by my colleagues and me. We have a big conference every June. Among other things, the Keele International CPower Symposium, or KISS, short, which this year will deal with NATO's Allied Maritime Strategy, where we try to bring together various militaries, people from the military, from academia, from politics, to discuss NATO's maritime strategy and the future thereof. And so that is where you can find, and anybody can find our work.
And this book is being published when?
This book, the book will be published end of March, beginning of April.
Any final thoughts?
It's great. Thank you very much for having me. I think it's great the work you do and to promote history. I think I taught history at school. I think it's, if you don't understand history, you don't understand the world. Fortunately, the experience I've made, that young people are very much interested in history from the ancient times up until the most recent history. So I think that is something that we have to promote. We have to encourage the study of history. And I think we're on the right track here. And thank you very much.
Yeah, I agree. And thank you.
Thank you for listening. More information can be found at warscholar.org.